Good afternoon. The time, 12:07 in the p.m. The place, KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane, the name of the show, Rabble Rousing. We begin by thanking Grass Valley Hydro Garden, serving the hydroponic and organic gardening needs of Nevada County since 2000. Grass Valley Hydro Garden offers sun system and hydro farm lighting, organic soil, fertilizers, ventilation, and hydroponic systems. Grass Valley Hydro Garden, 12506 Loma Rica Drive, 530-477-2996. Thanks also to Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service for homes, businesses, and public properties. Their specialties include site consultations, financial cost-benefit analyses, and project management for new construction and retrofits. www.planitsolar.com, 530-432-3776. Well, we're going to begin in the usual style, but we'll get mellower as the hour progresses. This is Rabble Rousing for December 23rd, 2009. First articles from American Free Press. Did Russia pull off its own 9/11 in September of 1999? New facts were established just in time for the 8th anniversary of the destruction of New York's World Trade Center towers to shock the nation with a sensational scoop proving spooks in high places planted bombs to pancake the buildings, slaughtering thousands to create a panic of unthinking terrorism as a pretext for war against a small Muslim nation to grab its oil and to set up an unassailable police state in the homeland. But the establishment medium that could have made history and become the number one news champion in the world killed its own story. Even without this story, numerous investigators have uncovered a plethora of facts proving the official story is nothing but a feeble conspiracy theory. In spite of all the evidence, there are still millions of Americans who refuse to consider the fact that demonstrate 9/11 was an inside job, with a so-called hijack conspiracy theory being nothing more than a false flag operation concocted with an orgy of planted evidence and official lies. Why are their minds closed? They don't want to believe any government would ever slaughter its own people as a pretext for war, to grab more power and advance an evil agenda? It is horrifying to accept the fact that villains in our own government to do such horrible things to us, but we can be more objective about another country halfway around the world. In September of 1999, 2 years before 9/11, Russia's 9/11 happened. A wave of terror swept Russia as a series of apartment buildings collapsed, much like the Twin Towers, from gigantic explosive devices, killing nearly 300 people. The Russian media blamed the crimes on Chechen terrorists. This made no sense. The war in Chechnya had ended in 1996, and in 1997, Boris Yeltsin signed a peace agreement recognizing Chechen autonomy. The Chechens had everything they wanted. They had no reason to provoke the Russian bear. But in the hysteria, almost no one was thinking rationally. On September 13th, the Speaker of the Duma, Gennady Selezniov, announced, "I have just received a report. An apartment building in Volgodonsk was blown up last night." An apartment building had just been blown up, but it was in Moscow. It was 3 days later when an apartment building in Volgodonsk was blown up. A member of parliament asked the speaker how he knew of the explosion 3 days before it happened. The questioner's microphone was shut off. Imagine Vice President Cheney telling Congress he just got word the North Tower collapsed, and a representative, Jim Traficant, asked him how he knew the North Tower collapsed before it did, then Traficant being hustled off to prison on trumped-up charges to silence him. The Russian speaker's blooper was bigger and more damning than even Larry Silverstein ordering, "Pull it!" to bring down World Trade Center Building number 7. Another strange and shocking incident happened on September 22, 1999. Residents of Ryazan, a provincial city 120 miles southeast of Moscow, were hypervigilant. They saw men carrying large sacks into an apartment building's basement and then sped away. They called local police. They found 3 100-pound sacks of RDX, the most powerful non-nuclear explosive in the world, wired to an explosive detonator and timer. Then a strange twist, with the potential to make even bigger headlines and history. Local authorities caught 2 of the suspects, who promptly produced FSB identification cards, FSB being the Russian FBI. Almost immediately, FSB headquarters in Moscow demanded the two agents be released. You gotta love this one. Corporate media recently informed us that Afghan insurgents are hacking into our drone communications, and hence are able to track them and know when and where our drones will strike. But the media forgot to tell us exactly how the insurgents are able to achieve this miraculous feat. But Charles Arthur, technological editor of The Guardian of the United Kingdom, spilled the beans by revealing this astounding feat of technology. It's a software called SkyGrabber, and it's freely available for $25. Quote, SkyGrabber is offline satellite internet downloader, the page begins confidently, at once informing the native English speaker that the page wasn't written by one. In fact, SkyGrabber is a Russian program. The site is apparently run by, I'm not going to pronounce his name, and Napobietka, Ukraine. SkyGrabber is a simple enough concept. Grab the signals that spill from a satellite broadcast, or even narrowcast, aimed from a satellite towards a specific location, and turn them into TV feeds you can look at. Or, as the website puts it, you don't have to keep an online internet connection. Just customize your satellite dish to select satellite provider and start grabbing. The U.S. drones would send their video up to a U.S. military satellite, the uplink, and that cannot be intercepted. The signal would then be beamed by that satellite or a linked one down to the controllers, who might be in Afghanistan or Iraq. Actually, it's been revealed that some controllers are here in America. Because that signal was unencrypted, anyone who tuned their satellite dish to the correct frequency and location in the sky could pick up the signal and decode it. And because any satellite downlink signal spreads a little, the area where it can be picked up is potentially huge. This weakness has been known for a very long time. In February this year, Adam Lowry, an ethical hacker who has spent a lot of time looking at satellite feed hacking, told the Black Hat Conference that anyone with a satellite dish can see data being broadcast, close quote, and the things you would expect to be secure turned out not to be secure. The most worrying thing is you can just see all this data going by. He's been at it since the 1990s, and in 97 could see French TV reporters beaming back closed-circuit coverage of Princess Diana's death to the UK over unsecured feeds. The only surprise is that the U.S. Army is surprised, given that it is known since the 1990s that the downlink from the satellite of the drone video was unencrypted. The Internet may have been invented in the U.S., but its knowledge has spread far and wide, and insurgents have used website and computer networks to organize themselves for years. My question is a simple one. Does anyone still claim that our military intelligence is intelligent? My commentary for today, December 23rd. All this hoo-ha about climate change was commented on in the San Francisco Chronicle quite nicely. The reader comments as follows. Do you fail to recall that back in the 1990s, Al Gore was saying that the Arctic would be ice-free before 2010? And let's say he's right, this time at least, and there is no more ice in the Arctic. So what? Guess what you will find under that ice? Land. Land that at one time was exposed to the sun, as there is already frozen grasses that they're finding when they drill under that ice. What does that tell you? That once upon a time, the Arctic was nearly ice-free, and then was completely covered in ice for a very long time. Eventually, the ice will melt, the land will thaw, fresh grass will grow, and eventually the ice will return again. It's called a pattern, and it's repeated itself hundreds, if not thousands, of times in the past, and will continue to do so for long after you and I are both dead and gone. So I repeat, so freaking what? Okay. One could say that's a rather callous viewpoint. One could point out that the island nations of the Pacific, which exist on coral reefs only a few feet above present sea level, might cease to exist. One could get really far out and posit that the Arctic once had arable land because of a tectonic plate shift, and that does not indicate that the Arctic as it is now situated was once warm. But the fact remains that climate change is a natural cyclical event, and the theory that it is entirely or even largely caused by man is just that. A theory. And that theory is supported by many reputable scientists. all of whom are being represented at the Copenhagen Convention. And that theory is disputed by many other equally reputable scientists, none of whom are being given a voice at that conference. I had to laugh out loud when I heard a KVMR broadcaster claim in triumph that all the invited delegates to the conference agreed on the reality of man-causing climate change. Earth to broadcaster, of course they all agreed. Only those who agreed were allowed into the conference. My question, why is all this debating done in secret? Why not have a public debate for the world to observe and then decide if man has caused and hence can change our climate, or if it's a natural cyclical phenomena and hence largely out of our control and we'd better learn to live with it? Okay, I really don't want to be politically incorrect, but I calls them as I sees them, and I'm growing weary of the slavish acceptance of the theory of global warming and the knee-jerk reaction to any questioning of this dogma. To those who insist that all scientists are united in their beliefs, I have four articles. All seem to be from Paul Joseph Watson, Prison Planet. I've decided not to read the articles on air, but for those of you who still have open minds concerning the reality of global warming and climate change, send me an email and I'll forward these articles to you. Then you can make up your own minds. You can email me at chamba@kvmr.org. Next item. After attending several wonderful holiday season parties, I've come to the realization that the single, indisputable advantage to having been born a male is the ability to pee off of the deck and into nature. Other than that, it seems to be a woman's world. Next item. Well, the alleged health care reform bill is almost complete. We now turn to Mark Stannard for his succinct synopsis. Quote, "So now the Democrats have handed us yet another cop-out concession on health care. So here's the scorecard. We get no single payer, we get no public option, and now we get no Medicare buy-in. We do get mandatory purchase of health insurance from profiteering corporations. So health care reform means millions of new customers for these corporations and no new competition for all that new business. That may meet someone's definition of reform. But explain again, please, why the Democrats are bragging about it." My addendum to Mark's commentary. Whoop-de-doo, all this fuss, and at the end we get screwed worse than before. Democracy, corporate style. You gotta love it. Okay, next item. Those of you who have ever been farmers or gardeners know what an incredible feeling of relief it is when your crop is finally harvested and put away for the winter. It's party time, isn't it? Well, imagine how it must feel if you lived in a village, far away from any stores or markets, and you were totally dependent upon the results of your harvest to feed your family for the winter. When your crop was finally out of the fields and safely stored away, it would really be party time, wouldn't it? In my travels, I once happened upon just such a village. It was at the edge of the Moroccan Sahara. It was around this time of year, and so I think it particularly appropriate. This is the last story I'll read you in my series of stories of my time spent amongst the people of the Arab world. I call it, never mind what I call it. I'll read it. You call it what you want. There's a wonderful story here somewhere, but I suspect I only glimpsed a part of it. I'd been knocking around Europe for almost 2 years, and the ski season in Austria was ending. So now what? Our cabin full of ski bums asked one another. Someone suggested Morocco. And why not? So that's where six of us headed. I don't mean to imply that we were all total sheep, but skiing puts me solidly into my right brain, and when I'm in my right brain, analytical thinking and major decision-making go right out the window. So if someone wanted to go to Morocco, that was fine by me. Besides, we looked on a map, and it wasn't very far. It was only three countries down and one over. We agreed to split up and hitchhike and meet in Gibraltar. As the ferry crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, I had a momentary burst of clarity and began to wonder just what I was getting myself into. Tales of the dangerous back alleys of Tangier flooded my brain. Treachery of the Kasbah, intrigue, white slavery. Feverish imaginations run riot. My travel mates heeded those stories and stayed close to their hotel. But in spite of all the stories I'd heard and the dire predictions of my companions, I just had to explore Tangiers. I promised myself that I would stick only to the main streets and be especially cautious and alert. The only problem with my resolve was that the main streets were a crashing bore. What beckoned to me, nay, compelled me to enter, were the very back alleys I'd cautioned myself against. What was going on here? Was this a game of facing my fears? On one level, perhaps. On another, it was just another piece in the slowly assembling puzzle of who I really was. The emerging truth was that I loved the back alleys of Tangiers, and I felt perfectly comfortable, almost at home, with the lower-class Moroccans. They were my kind of folks. I could appreciate their constant bargaining for what it was, a social custom, and a way to get to know one another. How much we in the West lose by our custom of just going into a shop, selecting an item, paying the price, and walking out. Shopping in the Arab world was far richer and more complex than the exchange of goods for colored pieces of paper. It was a game and a ritual. I spent my first few days in the souks, which are bazaars, with eyes in the back of my head, ever alert for villains with sharpened daggers, until I finally realized that those fantasies were the product of culture-shocked Europeans and had no basis in fact. I was at one with the Moroccans. They knew it, and now I knew it, and I might as well just relax and play with them. After only a few days in Morocco, I puzzled over why on earth I had wasted 2 years in Europe. The Arab world was incredible, and in Europe was dead boring by contrast. I puzzled more over why I was so comfortable amongst the Arabs. How did I instinctively know the subtle do's and don'ts of their complex culture? It puzzled me at first, but gradually I accepted it, still without understanding it. It wasn't till many years later, when I was introduced to the concept of past lives, that an explanation presented itself. How is it that we can be totally comfortable and familiar with people, places, and situations with whom we have had no prior contact? I've done much traveling, and still marvel that some famous places leave me cold, unmoved on any significant level, while others touch me very profoundly, resonate deep within me, and bring forth memories of familiarity and belonging. Sometimes it's exactly as if my feet have trod these very streets before. The concept of past lives was the only explanation that made any sense. I obviously had been an Arab before. It wasn't just that no other explanation made sense. There were never any other explanations ever offered. My understanding of and acceptance by the Arabs held true even in areas where my mind judged that I didn't like what they were doing. I could mentally disapprove and still know the correct and acceptable behavior. Nowhere was this more evident than in their attitudes towards and the treatment of their women. As we traveled around Morocco, I and my friends were often invited into homes. It seemed to be quite an honor for village people to host the Americans, and so there would often be subtle contests to see who would win the honor of taking us home to dinner. I found myself matter-of-factly explaining to my travel companions what was going on and how we should comport ourselves. "How did I know?" they asked. "I don't know how I know. I just know." I don't know about today, but at that time the Moroccan Arabs still veiled their women, and when we were guests in their homes, we seldom even saw the women of the house. Our host would sit us down, then bring out the elaborately engraved copper bowl and pitcher in which we were to wash our hands. He'd then remove these implements and return with mounds of food, and we would commence to feast. The feast was all prepared by the women, but we never saw them. As we ate, they would often peek around a corner to observe, only to retreat in giggles if they caught a male noticing them. If our host was liberal, after the meal, he might invite our ladies back into the kitchen for a brief introduction to his women. We men, of course, had to remain in the front room. On one occasion, we were entertained by a very progressive man, a university professor in Casablanca. His daughter was a student. On his own initiative, he brought his wife and daughter in to meet us, and we all conversed for half an hour or so. He cautioned us not to expect such freedom from his fellow countrymen, and he was quite right. It never happened again. So to travel in the Arab lands was to be exclusively in the company of men. It was as if we were in a world without women. Again, I did not approve. I did not like their ways, but I knew their ways, and so I could travel amongst them as a brother. For in the Arab world, there are brothers and there are strangers, and they have neither patience nor interest in strangers. Morocco held many surprises for me. Amongst these were goats that climbed trees and marijuana being smoked discreetly yet openly in the cafes. No, My seeing goats up in a tree was not a direct result of my keef smoking with the locals in the cafes. The goats of Morocco really did clamber up into the trees to munch on the leaves. As to the keef smoking, Western marijuana smokers could learn much from the Moroccans. Friends would gather in the cafes around a large circular table. One would offer his keef to his friends by placing his keef pouch in the center of the table. Then each would take out their own personal pipe. These pipes had a long stem and a tiny bowl. It held enough for one hit of keef. In the West, we tend to pass a joint or pipe repeatedly, till the fire goes out or until no one can move. The Moroccans have been doing this far longer and have this pleasure much more under control. They realize that not only does each man have a different tolerance, but that each should be free to choose just how high or out there he wishes to be. So the keef was there in front of us, and each dipped his pipe into the stash whenever he felt like it, and ignored it the rest of the time, whilst enjoying the company of his friends. Moderation seemed to be the rule of the day. But Morocco reserves its greatest surprise for those who cross over the Atlas mountain range and happen amongst a special people living on the edge of the great desert. I had split off from my two cautious friends for a few weeks, and was off on my own in quest of, I remember not what. A ride dropped me off at the edge of nowhere, somewhere between East Jesus and you can't get there from here. My highway was a dirt track, and branching off of it was an even smaller track that headed for a mud-walled village off in the distance. The village looked both fascinating and foreboding, exactly like a picture of an old fortified village from out of an old fairy tale book. The village was on a hot, dry, barren plain, the last possibly fertile land before the desert began in earnest. The mud walls rose out of the plain, massive and timeless. Built in an age when the dangers came on horse or camelback, the ancient walls still retained an intimidating character. It was growing late in the day, and here I was in the middle of nowhere. I pondered if I should chance ignoring these fortified statements in mud, that strangers here might be very unwelcome. As I was debating my decision, a pickup truck pulled up, and the driver got out in excitement. "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" he asked. "Yeah, a little," I replied in surprise. In German, I could converse quite fluently about dishwashing, fixing cars, and skiing. I wasn't sure how far my limited German would carry me in a mud-walled Moroccan village on the edge of the Sahara. "Wunderbar," he explained. "This village is my home. I've just returned from 3 years working at the Mercedes factory in Munich." He spoke in the slow and simple German of the non-native speaker, and as that was not too far above my level, it was quite easy to understand him. "I'm so bored here," he continued. "I have no one here to practice my German with, or to speak with of the outside world. Please, come and stay with us for a few days. It's the perfect time for you to visit," he added. "It's our wedding season. In fact, I'm one of those getting married. You will honor me by your presence, and you will see how we celebrate." Needless to say, wild-spitting camels couldn't have dissuaded me from jumping into his truck, and we roared off toward the village gates. He parked outside, for the walls had been built ages before the automobile made its first appearance, and the gates and streets were wide enough for men and animals only. He insisted on carrying my pack for me, and we set off for his mother's house. Curious, I thought, that he referred to it as his mother's house rather than his father's house. I assumed his father was dead. The surprises were just beginning. As we walked, I was struck by how clean everything was. There were no animal droppings on the street, though sounds of farm animals were everywhere, and absolutely no papers or trash lay about. The entire village was built of dried mud brick, held together by mud mortar. The streets were of dirt, and yet this was the cleanest town I'd ever set foot in. We arrived at his mother's door and stepped into a stable. "We all keep our animals on the ground floor," he explained. "People live above." We climbed the stairs. "This floor is for storage, our food and food for our animals." We ascended further. "These next two floors are my family's rooms, but the best rooms are at the top. That's where we entertain guests." My God, I thought. These houses are built entirely of mud, mud bricks, mud mortar, mud roofs, with wooden rafters, and they're all 5 stories tall. How long have these buildings stood here? I'm suspended 5 stories above the desert and supported only by mud. I had little time to worry if any of them had ever collapsed, for there were more surprises to come. We entered a sunlit room, whose windows exposed a magnificent panoramic desert view. The next view was even more astonishing. His mother entered the room. No veil, no shyness, no subservience. In fact, she carried herself proudly, almost regally. She brought in a tray of dates and camel's milk, offered them to us, and then sat down with us. I was dumbfounded. My host noted my surprise and asked what was wrong. In my halting German, I explained that I'd been in Morocco over 1 month and had never sat in a room with an Arab woman, nor even seen one without her veil. He laughed heartily, and his mother interrupted, obviously curious. He translated for her, and she laughed harder than he had. "But we aren't Arabs," he explained. "We're Berbers. This is a Berber village. Our people have been here for a time long before the Arabs came. The Arabs mistreat their women. They hide them away. They imprison them. Our people's ways are much different. This is my mother's house. If she and my father should quarrel, it is he who must leave. She is head of the family. Our women are very important here, the most important. We are not like the Arabs. It is she who welcomes you here." I smiled along with them at my foolishness, and then looked her in the eyes and thanked her. She asked a question, and he translated. "How do you like our ways?" "I like your ways very much," I replied. "It is very nice to sit with women and be with them as equals." As this was translated, her eyes sparkled with pleasure. She knew that the world was right amongst her people, but it was nice to have this foreigner agree. It seemed that the Berber society was a matriarchy, an island of sanity in a sea of Arabic insanity, and it seemed to function beautifully. We had a wonderfully pleasant afternoon, chatting away as the rest of the family filtered in from their chores. This was a farming village, they told me, and that it was their custom to postpone all marriages until the harvest was in. Then the whole village celebrated all the marriages at once. My timing was flawless. The marriage season began tonight. My host told me there would be dancing and singing throughout the night, more specifically for 4 nights. "We will dance and sing for 4 days and 4 nights. Most people will never sleep." My God, I thought, what have I gotten myself into? How am I going to make it for 4 nights without sleep? My host must have read the expression on my face, for he laughed and added, "You don't have to stay awake for all 4 days. If you get sleepy, just go off somewhere and go to sleep. No one will mind." Sounded strange, but certainly worth observing, I thought to myself. I don't recall exactly what I expected, but I most certainly wasn't prepared to travel back through time. We walked through the immaculate narrow streets that divided the 5-story mud houses. This feeling of being dwarfed by buildings I'd only experienced once before, and that had been in downtown Manhattan. How odd to duplicate my feelings of New York City here, on the edge of the Moroccan Sahara. We came to a clearing, a courtyard of sorts, not unlike a small-town plaza. There were multicolored blankets spread on the ground, and sitting upon them were the brides-to-be. Older women were scurrying about, fussing over the brides. My host explained that amongst his people there were very distinctive and differing styles of dress that differentiated unmarried from married women, and that the women never deviated from these traditional ways. Upon marriage, the maiden's hairstyle, facial makeup, jewelry, clothing, all were changed. The result was that even at a considerable distance, anyone could tell if a Berber woman was eligible or married. This, the first day of the marriage celebration, was the transition day. The transformation was quite dramatic. As we talked, the hairstyle of the maidens was being rearranged, hair piled and pinned on top of the head, in the style unique to married women. Their hands were greased so that the heavy bracelets signifying marriage could be slipped onto the wrists that would wear them for life. Then blankets were hoisted to protect from prying eyes, and garments were changed, again into the traditional distinctive garb of the matron. Before the eyes of the entire village, the metamorphosis took place. This courtyard was not unlike a cocoon. In the morning, enter the caterpillar maiden, and by evening emerges the married butterfly. The blankets were lowered, and the brides revealed. There was no mistaking them for maidens any longer. Their transition was complete. As the light softened with the sunset, a bonfire was lit, and the drums began sounding. The rhythm was very slow, almost hypnotic. The woman began to chant, equally slow, equally hypnotic. As the bonfire threw its lights and shadows on the surrounding walls, individuals arose and formed a line. They began to stamp their feet, slowly and rhythmically, along with a chant. I waited for the chanting to end and the singing to begin. I waited for the foot stomping to end and the dancing to begin. I waited. And then I waited still more. The part of me that waited grew impatient. This was all too slow for my 20th century Western mind. Could this be it? Was this all there was going to be? There wasn't enough action, enough variety. But I was a captive of my own curiosity. I'm here, and this is what's happening. This is what is. My mind struggled with boredom until a new pattern of thought eased their way into my consciousness, so subtly that my awareness hardly noted it. The slow, rhythmic drums and chanting filled my head, erasing firstly my judgments and finally all thoughts entirely. What remained was the throbbing of the drums, the monotonous, pulsing chant, and the slow, rhythmic rising and falling of the legs of the dancers. No other parts of their bodies seemed to move. Only the legs continued their endless pulsing, up and down, up and down. Endless became timeless. How long had I been here? Time became motionless. Time had stopped. Then it slid backwards. The question of how long had I been here was replaced by a larger question. How long had they been here? How many harvest seasons in these very fields had been culminated by marriage ceremonies exactly like this one? How many millennia ago had voices first been lifted in this ancient chant? How many generations of feet had stomped this same dance step into this same hard-packed courtyard soil? It felt as if this had been going on unchanged since the dawn of time. Taking all of this, I felt about as significant as a fly on the wall, a spectacle to the march of history. Was it even history? At this moment there was no history. There was no time. There was only this ritual, bringing young people together in marriage, who would then fertilize wombs and bring forth new people, who would then repeat this ceremony yearly. It was all just another phase in the endless harvest cycle. I journeyed with them back in time to the origins of this fertility rite. We all melted into sounds, rhythms, and the flashing of firelit shadows onto the ancient mud walls. At some undetermined point, my conscious mind returned and informed me that I was sleepy. Someone noticed my mind's return and invited me to get up and dance. I did so for a while, then felt self-conscious and could no longer get into it. For I was now in my mind, and this dance was too simple for the mind. To participate, one needed to be beyond their mind. I returned to my place on the blanket, and my mind and body both signaled that they'd had enough. In a state of complete sensory and intellectual overwhelm, I wandered off to find a place to sleep. My host was nowhere in sight, and then my Arabic wasn't good enough to ask for him. Besides, Arabic was nearly as foreign a tongue to these people as it was to me. God knows what language the Berbers spoke, and tonight God wasn't telling. I was very sleepy, lost in a time warp, and on my own. I walked in a near stupor until I found an open door. What a godsend, the room was empty. I curled up on a pile of burlap sacking and was asleep in an instant. I was awakened at dawn to discover yet another example of how pleasantly different Berber society was from the Arabs who surrounded them. My alarm clock was the village mezzouin calling the Muslim faithful to prayer. He sounded very close. He was. He was chanting out his summons to prayer from this very room. The faithful were filling in, spreading out their prayer rugs facing east and beginning to pray. I had chosen for my night's hotel the village mosque. I shuddered to think of the possible reaction of Orthodox Arabs at this blasphemy. The Berbers shrugged and laughed and went about their prayers. Their relationship with Allah must have been secure indeed. No sleeping foreign visitor could disturb it. I'll never know for sure if the mellowness of that village was entirely attributable to the fact that the society was run by the women, but I believe that to be the case. It was a most appealing society. That village was cleaner, more orderly, more peaceful, and more joyous than any place I've visited in the Arab world, if not the rest of the world as well. The Berbers were an island of matriarchy in a sea of patriarchy. It was a most graphic and impressive contrast. We men don't seem to be doing too well at managing our planet or our lives. Relinquishing the reins of power and inviting the women to run the show might be an experiment worth trying. It doesn't seem like they could do any worse than men, and if this Berber village is any example, they just might do a whole lot better. The time is 20 minutes to 1. The station is KVMR-FM. The place is Nevada City. Your host is Chamberlain. And we're doing some mellow rabble-rousing today. This is a quote from Leonard Cohen. What is a sage? A sage is someone who has achieved a remote human possibility. It is impossible to say what that possibility is. I think it has something to do with the energy of love. Contact with this energy results in the exercise of a kind of balance in the chaos of existence. A sage does not dissolve the chaos. If he did, the world would have changed long ago. I do not think that a sage dissolves the chaos even for himself, for there's something arrogant and warlike in the notion of a man setting the universe in order. It is a kind of balance that is his glory. He rides the drifts like an escaped ski. His course is a caress of the hill. His track is a drawing of the snow in a moment of its particular arrangement with wind and rock. Something in him so loves the world that he gives himself to the laws of gravity and chance. Far from flying with the angels, he traces with the fidelity of a seismograph needle the state of the solid, bloody landscape. His house is dangerous and finite, but he is at home in the world. He can love the shapes of human beings, the fine and twisted sharpness, shapes of the heart. It is good to have amongst us such men, such balancing monsters of love. Leonard Cohen. Okay, to quote Loudon Wainwright, suddenly it's Xmas a month before the day, so here's my feel-good story for today. According to New York Post, Mohammed Sohail, the proprietor of a deli on Long Island, didn't hesitate when he was accosted back in May by a man with a baseball bat who demanded money. After having his hands up momentarily, Sohail pulled a 9mm rifle from behind the counter and forced the would-be robber to drop his bat. After the robber pleaded for his life, saying he had no choice but to rob to feed his family, Sohail gave him some food, $40, and sent him on his way. The story would be astounding enough if it ended right there. But the robber surprised Sohail again just this last week with a letter containing thanks and $50. The letter discussed how the writer's life had improved since the incident. Quote, "Now I have a new child and good job, make good money, staying out of trouble and taking care of my family. You gave me $40. Thank you for sparing my life. Because of that, you changed my life." Sohail joked that the robbery ended up bringing him good fortune. When you do good things for someone, it comes back to you. I gave him $40 and he sent me back $50. It was a good investment. Okay, where do we go from here? Okay, you want an X-Men story? This one's from my favorite blogster, Fred Reed. Worse than war criminals, the case for skewering Santa's elves. I can't stand it. The entire United States has become one vast elevator, with lame carols raining down like a musical sewage outlet. Barely musical. There's no escape. Ring-a-ding-ding, ching-a-ling, ding-ding-ding, ching-a-ling, Santa Claus is coming too. A bad end if I catch the rascal. I'll hang him on fish hooks. Why do we put up with this saccharine compulsory gaiety? I'm dreaming of a... It would drive shellfish to wear earplugs. But we don't just tolerate commercial lemminghood. We congratulate ourselves on it. News reports tell us excitedly how sales compare with last year's. Television clips show people pawing at bins in low-end shop chutes, dropping half on the floor. All that tiresome yodeling about things that most people wouldn't recognize if they tripped over one. Half the public couldn't tell a reindeer from a hat rack. A one-horse open sleigh? Probably nobody alive has ever seen a sleigh. Or many of them, a horse. It's ersatz nostalgia for a world we never knew. Buy something. Actually, there may be hope. Christmas, as it was once called, is the suicide season, when people get depressed and off themselves right and left. Suicide suggests taste. It is a reasonable response to jollity contrived at corporate. Of course people kill themselves. They are lonely folk, trying to engage in obligatory cheer that doesn't work, while imagining that everyone else is simmering in the warmth and love that they see in the commercials. In truth, people seldom like each other that much, which shows good judgment. What you actually have is, on Christmas morning, bored and spoiled children opening package after package without interest. Ah, yeah, a CD of Clock Mortuary and the Jennerdeem Swine. I already got it from LimeWire. A fluorescent iPod cover that changes colors when you turn it. Whoop-de-doo. The whole thing is a fraud, a sad swindle, an ordeal. It is, however, a splendid example of Pavlovian conditioning. Pavlov is usually revered for torturing dogs, but he should be placed in a larger framework, as an early marketeer. Americans hear ring-a-ding-ding-ding and their eyes glaze over. Yes, they think. Yes, must buy. Something. Urgh. It doesn't matter what they buy. A ghastly sweater for Aunt Sally, reduced because it would embarrass an aboriginal in the Amazon rainforest. An espresso maker for Cousin Richard because, well, because it's 50% off, and who knows, Richard might like espresso. You see these automatons issuing from department stores, groaning under things they didn't want to buy, for people they usually don't like, who don't want whatever was bought for them. What can we buy for Uncle Fritter, who we'd rather never hear from again, but he just won't die? Oh, look, soap in the shape of a cute little burrow. Just the thing. What used to be Christmas and was a joyous celebration of Mithra's birthday, or the solstice, or something else reasonable, has become the winter holidays, or more candidly, the winter shopping season. It no longer has anything to do with Christianity, which has gone flaccid in the suburbs, and in the heartlands consists of lunatics waiting to be raptured up to heaven as if by a giant godly Hoover-matic. But you can't call it Christmas. We must observe the constitutional separation of church and retail. This fool business has apparently become the foundation of the American economy. I have read that without holiday sales, retailers of things nobody in his right mind would go out of... I have read that without holiday sales, retailers of things nobody in his right mind ought to want would go out of business. That's a lot of retailers. I'm for it. I mean, how many ugly ties can a republic stand? We're in trouble, I tell you. You think it's the subprime crisis? Nah. The holiday shopping season is going to do us in. We might stop doing it. The country is as force-fed as a pate goose with holiday bottles of shaving lotion and remaindered blouses, and if people stop gobbling, it's all over. Ask yourself, without the shopping season and high-pressure advertising, who would buy much of anything? Suppose that Apple computer couldn't advertise, but just put its new hiss-crackles on its website. Why isn't this reasonable? If you felt a compulsion to own an iPod with 37 buttons and a sonar depth finder, you could, but you'd have to want the thing enough to look for it. Ha! The economy would croak louder than an opera bullfrog. Wouldn't even need the fat lady. Actually, I knew the world was coming to an end when I read a holiday copy of SkyMall, that catalog they put in the seat pockets of airliners. In these magazines, they don't sell watches. Nope. Watches are low demographic for people with protruding orbital ridges. In SkyMall, the things are timepieces, a phrase redolent of Tony elegance and upscale antiquity. This is what an executive, actually a bulk lot salesman of cheap suits, desperate to conceal lower middle-class origins but not sure how, will buy a $3 Hong Kong watch for 300 green ones, so as to distinguish himself from lower forms of life, if there are any. Trilobites, mainly, or tube worms. Timepieces was bad enough, but there was worse. A wooden box with four holes in it. In it, you put your collection of timepieces, which, being the superior sort of being that you are, you would have. There was a little motor under the box to rock the timepieces back and forth. Remember self-winding watches? This thing would keep four of them wound. You know, your collection of antique gold Rolexes? You could put one on each wrist and ankle, I suppose. That's Christmas. A great mistake. I think the Romans had it right. Worship Magna Mater. Drink yourself silly and hold a taro bullium. There's certainly enough bull around. Tell you what, people, I'm the crack of economic doom. I'm not going to buy anything. I'm going to spend Christmas, I still call it that, no offense to Mithra, at home with my wife and child. 3 useless dogs and 4 cats, a good blaze in the fireplace, and not one lone, forlorn iPod. Maybe we'll invite Tom the Robot and, well, other curious folks. My daughter makes a wicked margarita that she, like she invented the idea. We'll listen to Scheherazade and Loretta Lynn. Well, Scheherazade doesn't actually sing. And tell lies. And if anyone comes near with a cute burrow made of soap, just thing for Uncle Fritter, we'll feed the some bitch to the dogs. Fred Reed, writing in Fred on Everything. Okay. Let's see. This email story came with a very sweet and compelling photos. I'll read you the text. True Duck Story from San Antonio, Texas. Something really cute happened in downtown San Antonio this week. Michael R. is an accountant clerk at Frost Bank and works there in a second-story office. Several weeks ago, he watched a mother duck choose the concrete awning outside his window as the unlikely place to build a nest above the sidewalk. The mallard laid 10 eggs in a nest at the corner of the planter that is perched over 10 feet in the air. She dutifully kept the eggs warm for weeks, and Monday afternoon all of her 10 ducklings hatched. Michael worried all night how the mama duck was going to get those babies safely off their perch in a busy downtown urban environment to take to water, which typically happens in the first 48 hours of a duck hatching. Tuesday morning, Michael watched the mother duck encourage her babies to the edge of the perch, with the intent to show them how to jump off. Office work came to a standstill as everyone gathered to watch. The mother flew down below and started quacking to her babies above. In disbelief, Michael watched as the first fuzzy newborn trustingly toddled to the edge and astonishingly leapt into the air, crashing under the cement below. Michael couldn't stand to watch this risky effort 9 more times. He dashed out of his office and ran down the stairs to the sidewalk where the first obedient duckling, near its mother, was resting in a stupor after the near-fatal fall. Michael stood out of sight under the awning, planter, ready to help. As the second one took the plunge, Michael jumped forward and caught it with his bare hands before it hit the concrete. Safe and sound, he set it down by its mama and the other stunned sibling, still recovering from that painful leap. The mama must have sensed that Michael was trying to help her babies. One by one, the babies continued to jump, each time Michael hid under the awning just to reach out in the nick of time as the duckling made its free fall. At the scene, the busy downtown sidewalk traffic came to a standstill. Time after time, Michael was able to catch the remaining 8 and set them by their approving mother. At this point, Michael realized the duck family had only made part of its dangerous journey. They had 2 full blocks to walk across traffic, crosswalks, curbs, and past pedestrians to get to the closest open water, the San Antonio River. The onlooking office secretaries and several San Antonio police officers joined in. An empty copy paper box, was brought to collect the babies. They carefully corralled them with the mother's approval and loaded them in the container. Michael held the box low enough for the mom to see her brood. He then slowly navigated through the downtown streets toward the San Antonio River. The mother waddled behind and kept her babies in sight all the way. As they reached the river, the mother took over and passed him, jumping in the river and quacking loudly. At the water's edge, Michael tipped the box and helped shepherd the babies toward the water and to the waiting mother after their adventuresome ride. All 10 darling ducklings safely made it into the water and paddled up snuggly to Mama. Michael said the mom swam in circles, looking back toward the beaming bank bookkeeper and proudly quacking. At last, all present and accounted for, "We're all together again. We're here. We're here." And here's a family portrait before they head towards further adventures. And as I said, this was accompanied by photos of this whole incredible adventure. Final item. Miss Beatrice, the church organist, was in her 80s, and she'd never been married. She was admired for her sweetness and kindness to all. One afternoon, the pastor came to call on her, and she showed him into her quaint sitting room. She invited him to have a seat while she prepared tea. As he sat facing her old Hammond organ, the young minister noticed a cute glass bowl sitting on top of it. The bowl was filled with water, and in the water floated, of all things, a condom. When she returned with the tea and scones, they began to chat. The pastor tried to stifle his curiosity about the bowl of water and its strange floater, but soon it got the better of him, and he could no longer resist. "Miss Beatrice," he said, pointing to the bowl, "I wonder if you would tell me about this?" "Oh, yes," she replied. "Isn't it wonderful? I was walking through the park a few months ago, and I found this little package on the ground. The directions said to place it on the organ, keep it wet, and that it would prevent the spread of disease. And it works. Do you know I haven't had the flu all winter?" There you have it, folks. Health tips from rabble-rousing, and probably far safer than the swine flu vaccine. Thanks goes out to to Grass Valley Hydro Garden, serving the hydroponic and organic garden needs of Nevada County since 2000. Grass Valley Hydro Garden offers sun system and hydroform lighting, organic soil, fertilizers, ventilation, and hydroponic systems. Grass Valley Hydro Garden, 12506 Loma Rica Drive, 530-477-2996. Thanks also to Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service, using sunshine, wind, and water to meet local power needs. Their specialties include on-site consultations, financial cost-benefit analysis, and guidance from education to installation. www.planitsolar.com, 530-432-3776. Okay, we're now going to go out with my favorite Christmas carol. That's actually the only one I really like. Mikhail is coming on soon with good news, and he's generously allowed to play some of it. We'll see how far we get.
That you write, and there are other songs that you just sort of write down. They come through you, and that was definitely the case for this song, so I can speak with it with a certain amount of distance. This came to me totally as a gift. 5 minutes, bam, it was there, and some of the most remarkable things that have happened to me in my life have happened to me because of this.